Some days you just want to amplify your everyday look. Like when you want the look of false lashes without the extra effort, reach for Thrive Cosmetics Liquid Lash Volumizer Mascara. Or when you want all eyes on your smile, keep Empower Gloss Ultra Glossy Lip Serum in your bag. It's a burst of 24-hour hydration that smooths like a serum, shines like a gloss, and can be worn sheer or layered. You'll always look and feel your best with Thrive Cosmetics. Plus, every product is 100% vegan, cruelty-free, and made with clean, skin-loving ingredients that work with your skin, not against it. Amplify your everyday. Go to thrivecosmetics.com/shine26 for an exclusive offer of 20% off your first order. That's Thrive Cosmetics, CAUSEMETICS.com/shine26.
Today on Misunderstood with Rachel Yucatel. What is so distinct about this death smell?
It's unbreathable.
Okay, let's go into the first like 90 seconds of a scene.
I step in and I take my hands off my ears and put them on my mouth. I take in the totality of the room, the feeling. So I don't close in right away on the body.
Did you ever follow the Ellen Greenberg case where the girl was found stabbed and in a locked apartment and her fiance said that she stabbed herself?
Is it possible for a person to stab themselves in the back of their neck 20 times? Yes, it is.
You were involved in the Thailand tsunami, also 9/11. Can you share how you deal with that mass casualty and what it is that you do?
9/11 was so... We had more than 20,000 remains. 40% of the people remain unidentified.
Most of us watch crime scenes unfold from the safety of a screen. Blue lights flashing, tapes stretching across the street, detectives whispering over evidence. But my guest today is a person who actually walks under that tape. Barbara Butcher has spent decades stepping into the toughest, most chaotic scenes imaginable. From everyday homicides in New York City apartments to the unimaginable devastation of 9/11 and the Thailand tsunami. As one of the most experienced death investigators in the country, she's examined more than 5,500 death scenes and nearly 700 homicides, determining the cause and manner of death, the answers that shape everything that follows. She's the author of the memoir, What the Dead Know, Learning About Life as a New York City Death Investigator, and now the host of Oxygen's new series, The Death Investigator with Barbara Butcher, airing Saturdays at 9 p.m. Barbara's job isn't about speculation or emotion, it's about precision. She notices the details most of us would miss, the open window that shouldn't be, the angle of a bruise, the way the room smells, the temperature, the silence. Her work isn't just about how someone died, it's about finding the truth inside the chaos they left behind. Today, Barbara joins me to explain what a death investigator actually does, the biggest mistakes police make before she even arrives, how science and instinct come together at a crime scene, and what really happens when life ends suddenly and mysteriously. This isn't TV drama, this is the real thing, and Barbara Butcher has lived it, smelled it, and seen it all. Barbara, thank you for joining us on Misunderstood. I've been watching your show and I am truly obsessed. So thank you for joining me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. It's such a pleasure to meet you. I love your show.
Oh, thank you. Okay, so let's just start with this. What is a death investigator?
When people think about death investigation, when they think about murder investigation, if they think in terms of the autopsy, a forensic pathologist opening up the body and figuring out what they died from. And that is true. However, what we're really concerned with is the manner of death. Was it a homicide, a suicide, or an accident, or a natural? So in the case of a gunshot wound, sure, you open up the head, forensic pathologist says, yep, death, cause of death, gunshot wound. I find the manner of death. I go to the scene where the death occurred and working collaboratively with the police, I do my own investigation into the body. I examine the scene. I examine everything around that body. And, you know, using forensics, some common sense and physics, I can tell you one of those things has happened. It's certainly not a natural death, but could be an accident, like cleaning your gun. That's a convenient excuse sometimes, but a suicide or a homicide. I'll guarantee you one thing. If it's a suicide, the gun is left behind. If there's no gun, to me, it's a homicide. So that's our first stint.
Right, right. Okay, but how did you get into this? Because it's not a straightforward path. I mean, I think a lot of people train in the medical field to get involved in stuff like this. You had a different path. So tell me how you got into this.
Well, you know, I was a physician assistant working in surgery and trauma and things like that. So I had that background. But actually, it was a career counseling service. I was bored at my job at the time. I was a director of a hospital. And, you know, I was bored. I wanted something.
What?
So.
Wait, that's so fascinating. Don't skip over that. What did you do for that job?
Well, you know, when I was a physician assistant, I got into surgery in this little hospital in the South Bronx. So it was like a knife and gun club. Very exciting. Wow. It was a great, great job, and I got to do a lot of good. But when a patient doesn't make it, it is devastating to me. I have too much empathy. So then they promoted me to director of, you know, public affairs, politics, blah, blah, blah. But that's not my thing. So I go to this career counseling service. They give me all those tests, Minnesota multiphasic, Rig Myers, blah, blah, blah. And they said, my counselor said, you should either be a poultry veterinarian or a coroner. I said, poultry? Why that? He said, well, you're good with diagnostics. You'd make a good veterinarian. But if it was puppies and kittens you were working with, well, it would break your heart if they didn't do well. Chickens, on the other hand, have beady little eyes. Nobody cares about them. They'd be perfect for you. I said, I'll take the dead people.
So, oh my gosh.
So, you know, coroner, that was a great idea. And I thought, well, I won't get involved because they're already dead. I forgot they have families and you get very involved. So the counselor said, call the one person in New York who you think has the best job in the world. I called the chief medical examiner, Dr. Charles Hirsch. He said, sure, come on in. And we talked and they offered me a job.
No way. That's amazing.
Yeah, isn't that something?
That is something. So what was your first role? Like, what did you have to do?
Well, the first thing I did was about 3 months of training. I went to the NYPD Homicide School, Criminal Investigation School. I went to the FBI's Scene Investigation School. And all the while, I went out on every single case in New York City with experienced investigators, with seniors. And there I learned how to examine the body, how to document it, photograph sketches, how to interpret the findings there on the scene, and how to work closely with the police, yet independently.
Right.
You know, we disagree sometimes, and I love working with cops. I come from a cop family. So I would go in there and have an absolute ball. It was the most interesting job on earth for a while.
Oh, gosh. Well, okay, but hold on a second. So I understand this is an independent job of the police department. So you work for the medical examiner's office?
That's correct, yeah.
Okay, but you're not one of the medical examiners who's doing the autopsy. It's in the field work where you're dealing with the actual body before it makes it to the morgue.
Right. I'm seeing the body in its original context at the scene.
Right.
So when I give my photographs and my written report to the medical examiner, they now have a context for the death. So a gunshot wound becomes a suicide or a homicide or an accident.
So is it always that a death investigator shows up, or sometimes do the police just handle this part?
The police have to call us if someone dies alone. So if they call and say, I've got an 85-year-old woman in a locked apartment, windows are locked, but her son got concerned and called us. Everything's perfectly normal. There's no trauma. She's in bed. And We got her physician's name off her heart medication, called him, and he says, it's fine. He'll sign the death certificate. But I don't have to actually go to the scene.
Got it.
But I do have to check it out in that way.
But like, did you ever follow the Ellen Greenberg case, I think it was, where the girl was found stabbed and in a locked apartment and her fiance said that she stabbed herself 20 times in the back of her neck or something? Do you know which one I'm talking about?
Yes, I do. Just recently that came up.
Yeah. So my question with that is, do you think they called a death investigator? Because the whole issue became with the medical examiner and they're trying to get him to change his testimony or whatever, his findings. And if there was a death investigator present, I would think that there would be a lot more to talk about, but it seems like people didn't like what he had to say. What were your thoughts on that case?
Yeah. As I recall, it was classified as a suicide based on the locked door. And the family is more concerned that it would be a homicide. And do you remember the jurisdiction where this took place, what town it was?
I think it was in Philadelphia. George, you can correct me if I'm wrong. Okay. I believe it was in Philadelphia.
Okay, then there would have been a death investigator at the scene. Philadelphia is, has good protocols, very good ME's office. So they would have sent an investigator. So here's the thought. Is it possible for a person to stab themselves in the back of their neck 20 times? Yes, it is. So when I got to that scene, and I noted that the doors were locked and the windows, very important, and I asked the police, how did you get in? If it's just the bottom lock, then it could be a slam lock. Mm. So I want to know that the bolt was secured. So it's easy to get in with a slam lock. So if the position was such that she could have taken a knife and stabbed herself like this, I'll believe it because I've seen it.
But why would anyone do that?
The reasons for suicide are varied. But in my mind, I classify them as two different types. One, or actually three. One is the sad suicide. Mm-hmm. A brokenhearted person takes an overdose of sleeping pills and peacefully goes to sleep in bed and never wakes up. Or the angry suicide, jumping off a building into a crowded sidewalk. The kids that go and do school shootings. Mm-hmm. They go out there, they shoot all these children, and then they shoot themselves. Mm-hmm. Now, why didn't you just kill yourself? Because they're angry and they want to make a big statement that people will never forget them. And it shows, hey, you didn't take care of me. So there's a third kind, though, that I recently has come to my attention, and that's the sort of psychotic break suicide. It's entirely possible to be a normal, well-adjusted person out in the world, but then go into a psychotic break, for instance, with bipolar disorder. And to harm yourself like that, is it difficult, painful, and a little crazy? Yeah, it is. But I've seen it done. Still, one man who shot himself in the heart twice. The first time, he didn't die instantly. He said, oh, what the hell? I got another few minutes here. He shot himself again.
Oh, my gosh.
And that time, he made it. I mean, he didn't make it. He died.
Right, right.
Accomplished what he was trying to do. I have seen people stab themselves repeatedly across their torso, even in the back. It's almost like a self-punishment.
Mm.
Think of it. Yeah. Yeah. There's something about that. That's self-hatred.
Yeah.
It's possible. If I were at that scene, I would be reenacting with everybody, get a woman her size, her approximate age, her health condition, and see, can we do that? Could we reenact that step?
So, okay, let's go into the first 90 seconds of a scene. Talk about what you're looking for. Are you going in always skeptical of everything? Does somebody start with you walking in, like we see in the movies, you go under the rope or whatever, and they're like, yeah, it's a classic suicide. Or are you like, let me tell you what it is.
Exactly. That's me. When the dispatch person calls me and says, Barbara, you've got a homicide in the 2-3 precinct. I say, who says? Well, the police said, no, it's not a homicide until I say it's a homicide.
Right. I love that.
And I'm not saying anything because then I'd get a preconceived notion. And what would I look for? Homicide. Mm-hmm. So I look for everything. So in that first 90 seconds, I get to the door and I ask the, well, may I be a little, I use...
Of course. Use whatever language you want. Yeah.
Okay. So I asked the HMFIC, that's the head motherfucker in charge, what have you got here? And he'll say, well, you know, obvious gunshot wound, bled out on the floor, no weapon is seen. All right. Thank you. That's it, though. I don't want to hear any more.
Right.
So now I step in and I take my hands off my ears and put them on my mouth like that. Listen, don't speak. Mm. I take in the totality of the room, the feeling. If I walk in there and there's scales and glassine envelopes and white powder and spoons everywhere and stacks of cash, I know I'm in a drug scene. Mm. If I come into a home and there's Birkenstocks and library shelves, PBS tote bags, that's a whole nother kind of life. So how you live often determines how you die. So I
do you ask for a few minutes alone, or are there like cops and people walking all over the place while you're doing all this?
Once they got used to me, all I'd have to do is, hey, guys, give me a second. And I'd just take it in. I'd walk through carefully. And then so I don't close in right away on the body.
OK.
I want the totality of it.
OK.
So, you know, I'll photograph and sketch everything and gradually I'll close in on the body.
Right. And then what are you looking for in a body to determine time of death, all the things that you're looking for? What do you get from the body?
Time of death is very important because that narrows down your suspect field. Mm-hmm. So what I'll do is at first I'll look at the rigor mortis. And, you know, you go into rigor over time, over about 12 hours. You stay rigidly stiff for another 12 hours, then you come out of it. And it's all related to muscle activity. Some people have lots of rigor, some people don't. If you do cocaine and you're a bodybuilder and you have a fever, you're going to go into rigor mortis almost instantly. Huh. A little old lady wasting away from cancer, it's going to take time. So I check that, then the algor mortis, that's the settling of blood. If you're lying on your back, the back should be purplish red as the blood settles. But if it's half on your back, and then I see that you're on your stomach, that means somebody moved the body after death.
Oh, could it not be a bruise from a fight they had before their death?
There's a difference. I can tell the difference between a bruise and
they look different. Okay.
Absolutely. So I'm looking for, and then the algor mortis, that's the temperature of the body. Okay. And I take a rectal temperature, but I do that last because I don't want to start messing with the body or moving it around yet. Mm-hmm. As I close in on the body, I get a sense of who this person is. Do I smell alcohol? Do I see multiple track marks from drugs, for heroin injection or other injection? And do I have a sense of what happened in this room? There's sort of a choreography of murder. You know, if I see someone with their throat slashed, mm-hmm. and against the wall, there's like a spray of blood and then a second spray lower down. Now I know they were standing there when someone cut the throat, and when the carotid artery was transected, the blood sprayed out under high pressure. Then the second spray was less pressure. Hmm. So now I know where was the victim standing? Where was the perpetrator standing? So that's what I'll start to interpret, a sense of where everybody was. I remember a case where I came in. It was a bar owned by two guys. Hmm. And the living guy said, you know, we were having a fight. We're partners in this business. We were standing and facing each other. We each had a gun. Mm-hmm. And suddenly he was going to shoot me and I shot first. No, you didn't. Because when I look at the body, which is face down on the ground, mm-hmm. I see that on the column of the wall, there's blood spray and blood spatter. So I know he was shot when he was down on the ground.
I see.
Okay. Yeah. So I know where that blood pattern was.
So it's What if I told you that the idea that you only get parasites when you travel to some exotic country is flat wrong? Millions of Americans carry parasites right now, often without symptoms. For example, it's estimated that millions in the United States have been exposed to Toxocara, a parasitic worm, yet most never even know it. Parasites do not need a plane ticket. They can enter through tap water, sushi, undercooked foods, or contaminated produce. Some strains live in all stages: eggs, larvae, adults, hidden in your gut, releasing toxins that sabotage your energy and digestion. That's why I'm excited about Parify, Kim Rogers' 30-day full-spectrum parasite cleanse. The kit works by clearing parasites, worms, candida, and heavy metals, targeting parasites in all life stages, supporting gut health, detox pathways, and toxin removal. It's taken orally, daily, for 30 days with precise dosing. I'm actually doing it myself right now. I started with the lymph cleanse, then I'm doing the Parify. Want to dive deep? I did a full interview with Kim Rogers, the worm queen herself, where we expose all the myths, understand the facts, and show how to protect your body. Listen to that episode if you haven't already. Meanwhile, go to rogershood.com and use the code Rachel to get 10% off of your order. That's R-A-C-H-E-L for 10% off. Give it a try. Maybe your body's missing link is hiding inside. Let's do this together. Again, it's rogershood.com, R-O-G-E-R-S-H-O-O-D.com, and use the code Rachel for 10% off. It seems like you can walk into a room. Well, first of all, so what are the difference in responsibilities, though? Because I would assume that the investigators, the cops, are looking at whether there are two wine glasses and only one person's in the body and on the floor, or, you know, that kind of thing. I don't know. But are they the ones looking at all of that? And you really are looking at what happened to this person and who they are in the room? I mean, you can find a body in a suitcase cut up in the ocean. Like, you know, there's all sorts of ways that it's not that easy in a room. So your job, I'm assuming, is figuring out the cause and the manner of the death. And it's the cop's job to, and the investigator's job to, figure out what was going on and how it happened also.
There's a lot of crossover there. If I am, if I have a strong feeling that it was a homicide, let's say that the person's head was bashed in or on the floor. That could be an accident. It's possible to slip and fall. Or it could be that they were hit with a blunt object. So we're looking around for that blunt object, of course.
Yeah.
And looking at the wound to get a better characterization. I can tell if it was a tire iron or a 2x4. So the police, their job is to take the evidence that I give them and the manner of death that I give them, and then go catch a perpetrator.
Right.
I don't chase suspects. You know, hopefully I'm in touch with the detectives and they tell me what's going on. But my job is to give them evidence.
Right.
That will lead them to a perpetrator.
To the suspect. Yeah. What do you think of cases that have become, you know, Netflix docuseries because they've never been solved? Did you ever follow the one about, I think it was called The Death on the Staircase, about the wife who fell down the staircase and then they thought it was the husband. They found out the husband was having a gay affair. And then he said it was an owl that came in and hit her in the face. Or, I mean, it was intriguing to watch. And to this day, you don't really know if he did it. Like, do you ever follow stuff like that? And you're like, wait a minute, I know whether or not he did it.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. In fact, it's strange. You've read my mind. I was just, when I thought about blunt force trauma, I thought, oh, of course, that case. Yeah. So he's in prison right now, I assume?
I don't know. I can't remember because I was so into the actual movie. And I remember he came up with this defense that it was an owl. And I was like, wait a minute, did he ever go to jail, as it was coming out of my mouth? I think he's in jail.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure he is. So anything is possible, except the fact that a person could walk down the stairs and fall and then hit their head on multiple planes, like this side,
oh, right. Ricochet their head. Yeah.
Yeah. That doesn't really happen. There was so much evidence there. There was blood spatter everywhere. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't the kind of blood spatter that, let's say you fall down forward onto the stairs, you're going to hit your face and your head. Your face may bleed and hit shoot outwards, but not high up on the wall.
Right.
So where are you falling? Even if you're tumbling down the stairs, maybe you break your neck. Maybe you slam your face. There's blood, but it's not spraying all over the place.
Yeah.
At different heights. No, that doesn't happen. And I do recall it was this guy, a detective called Jimmy Cold Case, because that's mostly what he worked on. But he was at a scene I came to where a guy fell down the stairs. It was obvious he was drunk, but he had a perfectly neat little bullet hole in his head. And, you know, I could prove that was an accident because he hit a stone corner at the bottom of the wall. It wasn't a gunshot. But then Jimmy Cold Case and I were on another case where a guy had blood everywhere. He was at the bottom of the stairs. And Jimmy said, I said, clearly a homicide. Jimmy said, no. What about if he fell forward, but then he caught himself on the rail and flipped to the side, striking his head on the right. Then it bounced, ricocheted to the left. Then he fell backwards again over the railing and hit his head on the mailbox. What do you think about that? I said, Jimmy, anything is possible except that.
Oh my gosh. So you are called to trial once in a while to testify as an expert in cases. Can they be cases that you were not the death investigator on?
Yes, that is possible. It's rare, but okay. If it's an old case and the investigator is no longer with the office, as the supervisor, I was, you know, the director of investigations, et cetera, I can go in and read from their notes and from their photographs and help the jury interpret what those notes and what those photographs mean. So yeah, it's done.
I see. But the trials that you're called to are mostly ones you were involved with from the beginning.
Yeah. And you know, just 3-4 weeks ago, I was called in for a case I did 31 years ago, 31 wow. years. A mother and daughter were killed in their apartment. And right away, I had an idea who it was, but we couldn't prove anything. We had DNA, but when you put it in the CODIS and the databanks, it didn't hit to anybody. So obviously, he had never been arrested before. Well, you know, we never give up. Cold case unit ran it again after 30 years, and it hit to somebody. And it's exactly the guy that I thought it was.
Oh, wow. So he was on trial?
Oh, yeah. So I got to testify at his trial and he was found guilty and he's being sentenced now.
Wow. Bringing something to closure like that has got to feel so good in what you do.
It sure does. It sure
wow.
does.
Wow. So in a lot of the episodes I've seen that you've done of The Death Investigator on Oxygen, you guys talk a lot about the smell. And we always see that in the movies. They make it very clear that there is a smell that goes with death. What is so distinct about this death smell?
That it is composed of multiple compounds. And there is nothing like them that you can relate to in any way. I mean, I've called it a strawberry milkshake made with garlic, but that doesn't quite catch it. It's the smell of feces, sulfur, deep decay, insects. It's a horrible, horrible smell. And no one's, you know, there are chemicals that are responsible for these smells, but there's something about the combination, and it's oily. So the air will settle in your hair and on your clothing. And it's just, it's unbreathable. And there's really nothing you can do about it. Forget about putting Vicks under your nose. It doesn't.
Does a mask prevent you from breathing it, or it still goes?
No. It's so insistent. It's so deep that even a mask, I mean, if you wore a complete gas mask. Of course.
Right, right.
But then when you took it off, it's all over your body.
Yeah. So, and I saw in a recent episode that I saw of yours that you had been upset with some detectives for opening a window, opening the door, because you actually needed to smell that smell to get some answers. Can you explain that?
Sure. The first reason I don't want windows open is because it changes the temperature of the room. And I need that temperature to calculate time of death. So you're sort of cooling the body down much faster than it should be.
Right.
It's 1.5 degrees per hour in a 70 degree room. So that's the main thing. But also the smells of alcohol. That's a very distinct smell. And if you've got breezes blowing through, I'm not going to catch it.
Yeah.
Also things like poisoning. There is a poison that for some reason has escaped my mind. It smells like choke cherries or bitter almond. Oh, cyanide. That's it.
Oh.
So I can, you know, I remember.
The one always used on the ID network to kill your husband or your wife. Yeah. Cyanide or antifreeze. I've always noticed that's a popular antifreeze. One.
That's a good one. Yeah. But of course, we're going to pick it up on toxicology.
Ah, got it.
And don't leave the damn antifreeze bottle around half full because we know that's a possibility.
Right, right.
I recall bending over a guy who just looked like, you know, ordinary death, passed away, a heart attack. But as soon as I got near him, I smelled choke cherries. Mm. And I said, let's look for some cyanide, guys. And we found it.
Right. So there is a difference, obviously, between going and seeing one person or just a few dead, as opposed to a mass casualty. Like, mm-hmm. I know you were involved in the Thailand tsunami, also 9/11. Can you share a little bit about how you deal with that kind of mass casualty and what it is that you do?
You know, the truth is, for a long time, I just didn't deal with it. Mm. 9/11 was so traumatic to work on because we were seeing things that were not imaginable, like two jawbones inside somebody's chest. Like, how does that make sense? The forces, the destruction, the disintegration of people. That was a rough one. Mm-hmm. And so for a long time, I didn't deal with it. And I just got more and more angry. I never wanted to go home. My relationship ended. And, you know, that was happening for a lot of us.
Yeah.
Drinking and, you know, cheating, yeah. All kinds of things. It was a way to cope. But we didn't cope. Then the Thailand tsunami. Oh, I do want to say one thing, though. At first, when in recovering body remains from the World Trade Center, I didn't have much identification with the people, that the victims, because nothing personal of that person was there. But then when I met the families of the dead, oh, my God, that wrenched my heart out of my chest, twisted it, dried it out, put it back like an old dried prune. Mm. It was so heartbreaking to see their pain, unbearable. And when I went to the tsunami, it was a horrific scene. Thousands of bodies laying out on the ground, decomposed and, you know, couldn't even recognize hardly a human being, recognizable as a human being. But
were these bodies ones that kind of they had been collected and put in one spot? Or,
yeah.
And that's when you came into that case?
Yeah, they decided to take the bodies, their body collection points or morgues were the temples. So that all around each temple, there were areas filled with bodies and trenches where we buried them. Because they figured, well, at least the monks can now bless them on their way to the next world, or whatever the belief may be. But there was something very interesting about the Thai people and their philosophy and their religion. Mm-hmm. And that is that even though they were devastated, they had lost their homes, family members died, so many terrible things happened. And yet, when the government said, we need to rebuild, we're paying 50 baht an hour, and trucks would go through the cities, through Bangkok, loudspeaker, come and work. People came, and they worked. They rebuilt the resorts because they depend on tourism. Mm-hmm. They rebuilt manufacturing. They rebuilt everything, and so much self-sacrifice. But meanwhile, they were living in little cardboard sheds or whatever they could get their hands on, dormitories. There was something about the call to duty and responsibility to the victims that was, it changed my attitude, changed my heart to see how these people handled death. And it's a lot of it has to do with their faith. So,
I want to go back to 9/11 for a minute. I don't know how much you know about me, but I lost my fiance in the World Trade Center. So I thank you for, you know, your service and what you did for us, because I searched high and low for him. I was working at Bloomberg News at the time. I was covering it. You know, I was there as a producer, but covering it, talking to him in the building. He was in the second building that got hit, but the first building that fell. And as you said, there was no, you know, identification on most people because it had disintegrated or whatever. And we looked for him and didn't find him until essentially right around New Year's Eve. And every so often I would get a letter in the mail and it would just have like a credit card that was frayed on the sides or an ID card or something. And it would come to my house. And that actually gave me hope because I was like, they're closer to finding him, even though of course that didn't mean anything. But those things were at least I had, you know, remember the time you like didn't know anything and you just wish you knew something and anything to hold on to. First, you're like, maybe they're okay underneath somehow. Maybe they made it out and I just didn't know. You know, you have hope in all sorts of weird ways. And then it became, I need them to find the body because I need to know what happened. I have to know what happened. I need to know if he was burned. I need to know if, you know, what it was. So eventually they found him. I got a call, I guess. It's kind of blurry. I can't remember, but I got a call and it was blunt force trauma was the cause of death. So I guess my question for you is when they found him, was it likely someone like you that decided the cause of death or were pieces of bodies and bodies transported to places, to morgues, and you guys were going through the pieces to figure out who they were and how they died? Like, how did that process go down?
First of all, I'm so, so sorry. That is so tragic to lose your fiance like that. You know, the resilience you have to just pick up and keep going is beautiful. And I'm so, so sorry for you. You know, we already knew the cause of death. Every one of them were murdered, every single one, by the terrorists. And our biggest concern was recovering the remains and identifying every single one. And as you probably know, of the more than 2,000, I think 2,430-something people were killed, we had more than 20,000 remains, some of them tiny, tiny, smaller than a dime, some of them even a piece of bone weighing 1 gram or less. And yet we had to take every single one of them and do DNA testing, do dental records, everything we could to identify them, to return the remains to the families. That's the number one objective. We know how they died. We know when they died. We know who did it. We know what time it was. We know everything about it except who they were. And so that became our mission. And Dr. Hirsch said that we would do whatever it takes for as long as it takes until every single person has been found and identified. You know the impossibility of that. 40%, after 24 years, 40% of the people remain unidentified. And that is because the forces of that implosion, explosion, and collapse were overwhelming. Absolutely overwhelming.
Wow. I didn't know that was the number that still hadn't been identified. That's terrible.
Yeah. And may I ask, were you able to have any remains to be buried?
Yes, I was. I, you know, they wouldn't let us see him, you know, but there were remains to send to the funeral home and bury him. Yeah. And I want to say that I remember asking and they said that he was, for the most part, intact. Yeah. It just, for whatever reason, I guess he was underneath stuff, so they couldn't get to him for, you know, that 4 months later or whatever it was. And so I didn't ask too many more questions, but I needed to know if he was like, if there was part of him left, because it just helped put it into perspective for me, maybe what he went through a little bit more. You know, I think for all of us that had somebody close to us, you wanted to know what their last minutes were like. And that to me was most important.
Absolutely. And most of the people died from the blunt force trauma. I mean, the compression forces, the collapse forces, people's heads were traumatized so so sharply, so suddenly, that most of them, I'd say, you know, died very quickly and from blunt force trauma.
Yeah, hopefully very quick and painlessly. All right. So in doing your job, what do you think was the most interesting, I guess I'll say, case that you came across that still, you know, lives in your mind today?
All of them. Frankly, every single case was interesting to me, even if it was just, you know, a straight out drug deal where three 15-year-old boys were shot on the top of the rooftop because they shorted the boss or something like that.
Right.
You know, I recall that. Was it easy to figure out what happened? Of course, they were shot. It was a homicide. But what was more interesting to me was the fact that these were three 15-year-old boys who their job, their purpose was delivering drugs. How does that happen? It's just so outside my experience of growing up. Now, yeah. My experience as an adult, being a death investigator and being in this business for more than 25 years, now I see the endless number of ways that people die and the endless number of reasons, but it doesn't mean I accept them. Mm. The casualness with which one could shoot three teenagers,
that's
what they had in their lives, these things haunt me. Some cases, I mean, it's not funny, but the fact that, a man was a baker, was working in with the dough in the bakery and kneading the dough, putting his hands in there, putting it all around. And he died, accident with the machine. But on autopsy, when they opened up his abdomen, he had tapeworms, thousands of tapeworms. So now I can't get over the fact that the bread that they made and sold, I mean,
oh my gosh,
were infected from that. I mean, it's not funny, but it's just one of those strange things in life. Like, damn it, that's going to stick with me now. How can I eat bread? But there was a case where I was quite certain that the wife had murdered her husband. It was reported as a suicide by an overdose of insulin. And it bothered me a lot because when the police, the daughter came home and found him dead in the bed. And there was a little note that just said, sorry, scribbled. She called her mother. Her mother worked a little boutique nearby, an art gallery with gifts and things. And she owned it. They were quite wealthy. And she walked home from the gallery and found him and then called his psychiatrist, who walked over about five blocks. And neither one of them called 911.
Oh, my goodness.
Until they were together. And they said, oh, let's call 911.
Right.
And then, so when I came into the room, you know, I saw the man.
Was she having an affair with the therapist?
That was my belief. As I walked into the room where the two of them were sitting, a detective said to me, Barbara, come on, this one's a little funny. Let's do this interview together. And as soon as I walked in, the chemistry between those two people was so electric. She was beautiful, Italian accent, Chanel suit, fabulous. Mm. He was in a, you know, bespoke gray suit, thick, dark hair, wavy. And he had that kind of relaxed insistence that superior people have.
Right.
Well, there I am in my cheap trench coat and my Talbot suit, you know. And when I went, I extended my hand to the wife to say, you know, I'm so sorry for your loss. And she presented her hand to me like that.
No way.
Did you want me to kiss it?
Oh, my gosh.
And there was a way, the way they were sitting, they were far apart, but leaning and curving toward each other. Mm. And to them, I was a nuisance. They were superior. And I had a very strong feeling.
So did they get away with it?
Yes, they did. Because, first of all, the psychiatrist, you know, he said, I've been treating him for depression. And the wife said, yes, he was terribly depressed and he had diabetes and it was hard to control. And I asked, who's his endocrinologist? May I have the name? And the psychiatrist said, oh, I treat his diabetes. Mm. Like, what? What? It's a complex and dangerous disease. Psychiatrists don't treat it.
Right.
So I had figured that the insulin in the bottle, which was empty now, had been changed for a stronger insulin. And so it was an accidental overdose that was actually a murder.
Got
that was my belief. It still is. But there was nothing to prove that.
Wow.
And for a while, I watched the Times wedding announcements to see if they were together.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I gave it up.
Right. Oh, my gosh. So do you have a different relationship with death now that you've seen it in all ways, shapes, and forms? Are you scared of death?
No, I'm not scared of dying. I'm scared of the way of dying. My hope is that I should be walking through a neighborhood and someone sees me and says, ha, you had an affair with my partner. I'll be 90 years old and they'll shoot me in the back of the head and I won't know what happened.
Right. And it'll be quick.
Quick. Even though I'm 90, people will say, my God, the tragedy. She was so vital, so spry.
Right.
She had a love affair and died for it.
Right.
It's a lot better than laying around in bed at 90 and people thinking, my God, why doesn't she just go away? So I'd like something dramatic and sexy. However, I do fear so many ways of dying because there is evil in the world.
Mm.
I've seen it. I have PTSD over it. I'm scared of people to a certain extent, so I'm hypervigilant all the time. Now, wow. Mind you, I get excellent therapy for this, for PTSD. Excellent therapy.
Yeah.
I'm getting over it gradually.
Right. Well, I'm curious, are you more of a recluse as a person or are you out there all the time? I mean, does it make you not trust people?
You know, I go back and forth with that. I'm an extroverted introvert.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoy being alone. I live in my head a lot. Mm-hmm. But when I get to know people, I love being around them. I go out all the time to see my friends. I'm out most every evening, but because I like to be around people I trust. But walking down a street by myself at night, my head swiveling, I'm taking in everything around me.
Yeah.
No one's going to get near me.
Right. Okay. So you have a show out. How close is this to reality? You guys are covering real cases.
Oh yeah. These are my cases.
Yeah. And so tell people, you know, what we should know about the show why we should be watching.
The show takes a death and shows you from the very beginning how it was investigated, what it looked like when I got there, what it felt like for us. And I've got the detective who originally did the case with me. So we're talking through the case. But now we're going to show you how it was solved, how it happened, how we solved it, how the perpetrators were caught.
Mm-hmm.
And because these aren't cold cases. These are ones that we've solved. But as I go along, I like teaching the viewer, the crime fan, the true crime fan, how we do it. I like to teach them about rigor mortis, what it means and how it gets there and what it doesn't mean and how you can fake rigor mortis. So I like to teach them about those things. So I do talk a lot about what that finding meant. Some of the cases are like this season, we did half of them in New York, my cases, and half of them out in Las Vegas and Virginia, because there are detectives I know out there. And we've talked about these cases. So I go out, meet up with them, and we go through the case there.
Right.
So it's a mystery. It's true crime. And it's a little bit of a teaching experience.
I agree. I've loved watching it. It was absolutely a teaching experience, but also interesting to watch because I'm a true crime fan. You've also written a book, What the Dead Know. And what did you want people to finally understand about the people that do this work?
Well, you know, the first draft of that book, I sent to my editor. I went to meet with him and he said, Barbara, where are you? I said, I'm right here. He said, no, where are you in this book? I want to see what you see and feel it and smell it and hear it. Mm-hmm. I want to be there with you. Rewrite it. So I said, oh, you want me to cry? He said, yeah, go deep. I did. I rewrote the book and I made it much more personal. And in the book, I talk about the interesting cases or the strange things I've seen and learned, but moreover, what it feels like to be a person doing that work, a detective, a medical legal death investigator, what we go through, how it changes lives. And the fact, you know, I speak a lot about this at conferences, how much we need help. PTSD is a killer. It absolutely is. And I want people to know what it's like to do that job, to be in my shoes there. So yeah, the book is full of cases. It teaches a few things, but it also shows you what it's like to do that work.
Yeah, and how hard it is. Yeah. All right. Is there something that you're doing now, or are you filming? Or are you still actively a death investigator?
I did private work for a while after I left the medical examiner's office, but that became too heartbreaking. Mm. You know, families may not agree with what police determined, and they asked me to reinvestigate. The majority of the time, it is what the ME said or what the police said. Mm. And it breaks their hearts because they want something different. I do have a case right now, my last case, in which the ME was wrong. And I can prove it. So it's still rattling around in court. But in an act of self-preservation, I decided to do creative things in life, like write the book, like do the TV show. Mm-hmm. So right now, the TV show is airing. It'll be done November 29th. And I'm looking forward to a second season.
Good.
Currently, the show is doing very well from what I see.
I can imagine. Yeah.
And I'm also, we're starting to produce a podcast.
Amazing.
Where I interview experts in the particular realm of what the case was. Like if it's DNA, I'll bring on a DNA scientist. Mm-hmm. If it's a machinery death, I'll bring in a forensic engineer. So, yeah. So the podcast, I like to stay busy.
Good. And will you bring up cases that are current in the news and talk about your thoughts on them?
Yes, I will. You know, I do get asked to do that a lot. What did I do last? CNN. The Gene Hackman death.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So I did a lot of interviews on that, and I opine on various cases. But I'm very careful about that because if you're not at the scene, if you don't know what the scene held, you don't have the photographs, the reports, or the original people, you can get fooled. So, I tell the evidence and I tell my interpretation of it without saying, definitely a murder.
Right. But are death investigators like friends? Like, could you pick up the phone and call the death investigator in the Karen Reed case and be like, what the hell happened?
On the Karen Reed case, I can pick up the phone and call the forensic pathologist who did the case. Mm-hmm. Excellent, excellent job on it. I'm friendly with a lot of the folks in the business, so it is a good thing.
Yeah. All right. Well, I am so excited to keep watching. I will be really excited if there's a season two. Anything else on the horizon, a bucket list that you want to accomplish in life?
Yes. I'd like to see the movie. The movie, Barbara Butcher.
That's right. I love it. And by the way, it's the perfect name. Is that your real name?
Yes, it is. Butcher is my name. And it's one of the best gifts my daddy ever gave me. It's so perfect for this job.
It is so perfect. And I know people call you Dr. Butcher because it sounds so perfect. You are not a doctor. Just explain that, because I know that people try and take credibility on the stand and say, you don't know what you're talking about because you're not a doctor. But explain why you're not and why it doesn't matter.
Yeah, the doctors, the forensic pathologists, they do the autopsy. It's based on anatomy and physiology. Yeah. The person who does the scene investigations doesn't do autopsies, doesn't need to know all the medicine, but needs to know the scene and the body in the scene. We're trained to be observant, interpretive, thorough, and detailed. But we don't do autopsies. So you don't need to be a doctor. You need to be smart and have a medical background.
Right.
Or, you know, forensic background.
Amazing. All right, guys, you need to pick up the book, What the Dead Know, and also make sure you're watching Oxygen, 9 p.m. Saturdays, The Death Investigator with Barbara Butcher. Thank you so much for joining us today. I wish you the best of luck.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you so much for listening to Misunderstood. I'm your host, Rachel Yucatel. Please be sure to subscribe to the show and give us a 5-star rating and review. You can support the show by joining our Patreon at patreon.com/misunderstood with Rachel Yucatel. Do you have ideas for the show or want to reach out? Email us at info@misunderstoodpodcast@gmail.com. That's spelled MISS understood. Thank you so much, and I'll see you next time.